What are you going to play, Sam?
We're going to play Take Me Out to the Ball Game. We're all going to sing it, too.
Welcome you into the first Meet Me at Mutual of the second half. I'm Daniel Shockdahl, your host, C70 at the bat, at C70 on Twitter. With me is the regular co-host, Alan Medlock, a Medlock one on Twitter. But we also have, joining us for the whole show, not just a little pre-recorded segment, whether this is a good idea or not, you can tell us later.
Terrible idea.
Yeah. Kyle Reese from Redbird. Both of these guys from Redbird Daily. I'm getting teamed up here. Kyler is, of course, on Twitter at KyleR416. And you're probably already following us, but if you're not, do that. Also, we, like to encourage to subscribe to the show, rate, review us at wherever you can. Unless it's bad, and then we don't want to hear about it, which may be why we're not getting a whole lot of them. just let us know on Twitter how bad we are. If it's good, go ahead and write it down on iTunes, because that lasts longer. So, anyway, Cardinals get back to it tonight. The second half kicks off with a series in Pittsburgh that Kyle, at least I think, is kind of important. I think if the Cardinals stumble this weekend, that changes the philosophy of John Mozeliak and Michael Gersh, perhaps more than anything, and they, didn't come out of the gate strong tonight, losing on a home run by someone 0 in the ninth inning. What do you think about this series? Is this kind of the key, or do they have? I know they have the Cubs next week. Do they think that it really that one is more important?
It's the way I look at it is, I feel like we're at the end of the season as much as we are at the beginning of the season, where every little series has a huge microscope magnifying its importance. They put that 4 to 6 week time frame. I guess that was about 3 or 4 weeks now at this point.
Actually, it's been about 6 now. We're really at the end of it. Yeah.
Yeah. So I would say, based on that time frame alone, that this is about as important of a series as we've had. And to come back from the All-Star break, the way that they ended before the break, with a lot of momentum, and to lose the way they did tonight, like, they just cannot afford another loss. They have to take 2 or 3 from Pittsburgh. That I believe that will put them on whatever course for the rest of the season, and that's I believe that's what management should do. Whatever happens this weekend should correct them, should put them in line for whatever the future is for this season and the following seasons.
Alan, it was, as we pointed out, it was a tough one, because they come out and they score 2 runs in the first inning, and then they don't score again. And I know this offense, people continue to complain about it, but it's been working pretty well as of late. It's just, I guess, I don't know, where do you blame tonight's loss on? Is it the offense, or is it more the pitching?
I would have to say the pitching on this one, just because I felt like they hit a bunch of lasers right at people tonight. Especially there in that seventh inning where they had a chance to score and they hit 3 balls that were just right at people. That first inning was about as well mapped out as any inning they've had this year. That's exactly what they thought all their first innings would be this year, but they really thought it'd be, you have the leadoff walk with Carpenter. How did it work out? You had the 3-2 count on Carp. You had the single by Pham. You had the 3-2 count by Fowler, and then you had the 3-2 homer by Jerko. Well, that wasn't necessarily the factor, the 4 people they counted on doing that, but that's kind of how they mapped out their offense all year in that way. But then, I don't know, you just have zero confidence in the back end of the bullpen right now. I still think Rosenthal has to have that ninth inning, just because he has that strikeout stuff. When you give up that the leadoff double like O did, he doesn't have the strikeout ability like he did last year, and people are going to move the ball around. You know, that was a 1-2 pitch to a lefty who lefties have just mashed him all year. I thought that the ability for them to tie the game, I thought the strike zone was tight. And it was really, I don't know, it seemed like it favored that outside strike zone, and I think Leak struggled with that. So kind of, I would say that the defense kind of failed them a little bit today. Not necessarily the defense, but the pitching side of the ball more so than the offense. I mean, I really thought they would lose tonight just because Cole would carve them up, and he pitched pretty well after that first inning, but they hit a bunch of balls right at people. So, you know, it can go either way, but, you know, they still seem to be hemorrhaging in that eighth and ninth role.
Yeah, I mean, I pulled it up. You know, coming into tonight, the 20 games into the All-Star break, you know, they're averaging 5.5 runs a game, averaging a homer and a half a game. Right now, I don't feel like the offense is just a huge problem. I mean, some of that was skewed by, you know, that 14 run game against Miami or whatever. But, you know, they're going to have nights like that. Everybody has nights where they just don't hit, and that happens. I mean, I'm not going to complain. Not that, you know, not that they don't need to add that big bat, and we'll talk about that probably a little bit later on, what that will be. But yeah, you just hated to see it. I mean, I think you hated to see Mike Leake walk the bases loaded with two outs and give up the single.
After a double play.
Yeah. I mean, a guy that went like three starts before he walked his third batter this year, you know, to put – and granted, you're right, that strike zone was iffy all night. There were some weird calls on both sides. I know I saw some people complaining about Jerko's at bat in the first, saying he should have been struck out before the home run. So, different things like that. So, but you still, I mean, a tight strike zone's one thing. This Lake was throwing some pitches that, you know, I wouldn't have swung out. And I swing at everything. So, so he just – It's frustrating. This was just one. I feel like, if nothing else, this is just one of those games.
Sure.
If you take it in isolation, the problem is, it's not. I mean, like we were talking, it's an important series, and it's the first game back, and you really want to see them come out on the right foot, and it didn't really happen. So I don't know. And like you said, like Kyle said, I think you're right. Winning two out of three is real important for a lot of people's jobs. Going forward, I don't know. I mean, Kyle, what do you think? Is this? I mean, I was watching Leak tonight, and I was thinking, you know, he's really starting to revert back to what we saw last year. That first couple of months seems like so far away now. I mean, is there any chance he gets back, not to that level, but at least somewhat close to it?
You know, without looking at his stats, I feel like he goes through a little. He gets like a little jolt at the beginning of August. I probably should look it up, but he's always been kind of a streaky pitcher. You know, it's rare that he gets off to like a blazing hot start like he did this year, and I think he'll get another 4, 5, 6 starts where he's issuing some quality starts. But I definitely don't think he was as dominant as, or he has the potential to be as good as he was at the beginning of the year on a regular basis. You know, one more thought that I had about tonight's game is there a perfect, like, this is the first game back from the All-Star break, and it is the most like microcosmic example of what the first half of the season was for the Cardinals, right? Like, it's symbolic in the fact that it shows that very little has changed. Like, it was everything rolled into one, right? You kind of had a pitcher who was grinding and got through some tough innings, and, you know, they had a lead early, and the bullpen blew it, and there was a bad pitching matchup late, and, you know, the strike zone was kind of weird. It was just like, this game is just the perfect, like, little blooming onion of all that had gone wrong in the first half. And I think that's why, like, normally these losses aren't as brutal on me as this one is. I feel gut punched. I feel exhausted after this loss. And you kind of knew that they were flirting with it, and you were apprehensive, especially when O got brought in the ninth. Mm-hmm. And, man, like, that's where I'm stuck at. You know, I think Mike Leake's fine. I think he's exactly what you pay him for, to be a 4-5 starter. you know, he's going to be that. He'll always be that. He might show signs of being a mid-rotation guy, and he might show signs of being better off as a long man out of the pen. That's just what his repertoire is, especially if he can't get the ball to sink, which ends up always being his problem when he struggles. But, yeah, that's who Mike Leake is, and that's my problem with tonight's game.
I hate to undercut your
point. Oh, God.
But Mike Leake, for Mike Leake's career, and this is it could be skewed from early on or whatever, I don't know. But for Mike Leake's career, his worst ERA is in August, and his next to worst ERA is in September. By a significant amount.
Daniel, why do you hate me?
Well, you know, we don't really have time to go into all that. So, so yeah, I mean, I get you. I thought I could see that, but in of course, you know, I know that San Francisco Giant fans are not fans of Mike Leake because of, you know, they traded for him down the stretch and he was hurt and then ineffective.
That's right.
And, you know, when you get into Cincinnati, you know, he's pitched his career that way. You could see that ball probably flies more. I mean, there's lots of different reasons, but it is a little concerning to see see those numbers, unfortunately. So, I guess the only thing we were missing tonight, Alan, for that microcosm was nobody got thrown out at home or anything like that. So I guess there were some positives to take out of tonight, just not a lot. I guess one thing is, it's still Jed Jerko. I mean, and that kind of goes with the first half. Jed Jerko has carried this team quite a bit.
Well, the positive I want to say may get people to hang up on us, but the best positive that may be taken out of tonight is that Viscotti got hurt, and now we finally get to see somebody else at the other play. I don't know how much more I can take of Viscotti. I don't know. He's been their worst position player all year, and I understand there's reasons, but now it's getting to the point to where he had that one little two-week stretch last month when he came back, but now it's kind of time to maybe start looking at some options. If they do upgrade, I have a feeling it's going to be in the corner outfield at this point, where I didn't think that was the case, maybe even yesterday. But other than that, you're right. Nothing is ever firing on all cylinders with them. It's bizarre. And even to take this a step further, the Cardinals had to start in Pittsburgh in the second half. The Cubs had to start in Baltimore, and then Milwaukee starts at home with Philadelphia. So they could lose ground and win the series. So yeah. It's a tough go right now. So, like I said, I kind of expected Cole to carve him up tonight. I don't know why. I just had a feeling that he was going to pitch pretty well. It didn't go kind of like I thought it would. But, you know, still, it's just frustrating how they just can't get a leg up. You know, you lose a game, first night out. So, you know, late a game in the standing at his first night out. So, you know, I don't know. Maybe they are who they are, and it's kind of depressing.
If you take moral victories, you know, the Cubs had like an 8-0 lead, and it's 8-6.
Yeah.
And I think the Brewers jumped out to a huge lead, too, and it's 9-6. Granted, both those games are probably going to wind up that score, and they're both going to win, but... you know, there's still obvious flaws there. You know, Steven Piscotty, you're right. Since he hit two home runs in Baltimore, but since that time, he has not hit a home run. That's 20 games, 17 starts, .217 batting average, and 21 strikeouts over the past. And I will say, I mean, what I saw him tonight, I mean, he just took some terrible, I mean, they're just terrible swings. I mean, he didn't have a clue what was coming. So, you know, maybe it will be a blessing in disguise for him for the team for him to get some more time off. This also means with Randall Grichuk hurt, and we'll just use this to kind of springboard into what has happened with the roster and what could happen. With Piscotty hurt, it would seem that Magnaria Sierra is going to come back up because it's either him, Chad Huffman, which doesn't solve anything, or you start messing with the 40-man. And you know, Kyle, you can tell us. I'm sure that Harrison Bader is ready to go, but it's still one of those things that you're not going to play him unless he's going to play every day, right?
Yeah, that's definitely the situation. If they want to add Harrison too, they've got to do some cleanup on that 40 man. Mm-hmm. They eventually they're going to have to put Zach Duke back on it. He's on the 60 man. or the 60 day, I mean.
Right.
And you know, again, I need Alan, Alan or Daniel. I need you. I think they're up against it on the 40 man, right? So, if they,
yeah,
if
they've already moved Alex Reyes to the 60, so.
Right. Yeah. So if they bring up Bader, that would mean that they would have to designate or pull someone off of the 40 man, and probably be Breivik Valera more than likely, which isn't a big deal. But Valera is starting to hit a little bit too, so maybe you don't want to DFA him. They'll do whatever's best for the big club, of course. But yeah, to me, Sierra is the path of least resistance. He's hitting really well. You know, he's getting a decent amount of extra base hits in Springfield, and you know, doing what he does, which is just kind of hammer the ball around a little bit and get on base. And you know, that's definitely the move I would make. But the thing with Sierra, and this is again where the lineup dynamic of this team makes absolutely no sense and works against itself, is all of Sierra's value is in center field. And if you're not going to play him in center field, you know, his two skills are defense and speed. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you're nullifying his biggest skill if you're not putting him in center field. And he's not going to play center field as long as Dexter Fowler's on the roster. And that's going to be for 5 years. Yeah. So, you know, at least in the immediate future, we'll say. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, they'll bring up Sierra, and he'll hit eighth, and everyone will love him until he stops hitting. And hopefully by then, Piscotty will have his brain back together.
Yeah, I think that they need that. I was afraid that you guys were going to say that's not the move to make, that they should rearrange the 40-man and go with Bader just to give him a shot. But I think they need Sierra. I mean, I think that's exactly what they need. And it's funny, I thought about, I can't remember what point I was going to make on that, but you reminded me of something. During one of the Q&As this year that Rick Hummel set in for Gould, he said, Sierra will be the guy that unseats Fowler in center field. Yeah, we know it's not going to be this year, but I think that's a plan long term.
And it well may be, but it, like Kyle said, it's coming not soon.
Sure.
You know, I mean, even Dexter has said he didn't care where he hits, but he signed to play center field. And that's fair. I mean, you know.
I agree with that. Yeah, that's.
Because, I mean, it's understandable that, you know, in year four or year five they shift you, but, you know, year half, you wouldn't. That's not really what you signed on for. It will be finally interesting to see three center fielders playing outfield. You know, that should be.
Yeah.
Nothing should drop, you know, if nothing else.
I'll tell you, that's exactly what's going on in Springfield right now with Sierra, Arozarena, and Mercado for the last three games, and nothing drops in between those three. And all three of them have really good arms, and they all can play center field. So, it's exciting. It's something, you know, even if he's patrolling right field or if he's in left and Fam goes to right, you know, however they align the defense, that is something that, you know, is positive. It is something good. It's something that's better for the team. Like Alan mentioned, Piscotty's been so abysmal, subpar in the outfield, you know, as much as he's lacked power at the plate. So, that's a positive.
Yeah.
Well, and like I said on the on these podcasts, if they're going to play 500 baseball, I'd sure as heck rather be with the prospects than what the everyday roster would be, you know, just to see. So that may be pointing into that, maybe kind of going into what we had talked about before. If they're not going to make a move, but if they're going to play 500, let's see what these guys can do.
Yeah, I think that's very possible, and we'll just have to, you know, wait and see, but. You know, the roster got some other shakeups as well. Not shakeups, but, you know, the fact that they sent Luke Weaver and they sent Alex Mejia down over the break so they could promote or activate Colton Wong and Kevin Segrist. And then today, before the game, they put Grichuk on the DL and brought up Jose Martinez to fill that spot. Let's talk about Grichuk first before we get into those other ones. You know, it's always a little strange when a guy's been, you know, off for 4 days and comes back and goes on the disabled list. You know, Alan, exactly what was Randall Grichuk doing the last few days?
Did you hear what Matheny's excuse was?
No, I did not.
He said he slept wrong and woke up, and I was like, Well, I don't want to, I don't even want to say what I was thinking. But but yeah, I was like, this is a little fishy. You know, I don't know. It just seems like all those moves this year, there has been some kind of string attached to it. I don't know. It was very bizarre. So whenever that news broke today, I was like, well, we haven't thought about that at all. And here I was hoping that we'd get into a stretch to where Grichuk and Piscotty could duke it out for playing time and they could let Pham play every day. Well, Pham's going to get to play every day, and now we won't get to see either one of those guys. So, I don't know, that may be a bonus, but I don't know. Any of those moves, I'm always skeptical.
Yeah, I mean, sleeping wrong seems to be one of those things that is a day or two. It's not a Tuesday. Yeah. Now, granted, I mean, I'm an expert sleeper, so I don't really have this problem. You know, I just, you know, I could sleep no problem, but, you know, maybe Grichuk doesn't sleep enough, and so wasn't in shape for sleeping, and so that really ruined him. I don't know, but you know,
I get the feeling that maybe Grichuk is using those sleep hours for other activities. That's
yeah.
But go on, sorry.
Don't make me put a rating on this one, okay? Let's just move on.
Oh,
from
there. Man.
But anyway, yeah, no, I mean, I saw some people referencing, you know, I think he might have been on the trip with the guys to Branson this weekend. You know, did he jet ski, or did he do something else that wrenched it? And again, even if he did something like that, I mean, that happens. I don't think you blame him for that. It's just not necessarily the best look, I guess. But that's the way things are. And it may have been something else. I mean, yeah, I'm not going to go with the sleep issue. I don't think that's it. You know, some people suggested he'd been working out too much, that he'd hurt himself working out like he had before, which is, I guess, possible. But it is... I don't know. I mean, it's one way to clear up the roster issues, but it's not really how you draw it up. Because, like Alan was saying, you want to see Randall Grichuk go out there and perform, if only because you're not going to get him off your roster otherwise. If he's bad, you're kind of stuck with him unless you just waive him. And I don't know that the Cardinals want to do that. But if he could show any kind of potential, then, you know, he can be a toss-in and a deal. But he's got to be healthy to do that. And Kyle, right now, he's not.
No, he's a mess. It's been a weird year for him. Do you think he gets injured every year on purpose? Like, he seems like the kind of guy who maybe just wants to go on vacation, maybe. Maybe take his best buddy Piscotty with him. Like, I say that in jest, but... This is a thing for him, right? Injuries are a thing for him now. And to be as young as he is and as fit as he is, and to have a shoulder injury and knee surgery and a back issue, and there's been a couple other things in there. It's more than just something to look over now. It's an actual issue. And like you said, if you're off for, you know, a good amount of time and you come back and you don't even get a chance to play, that's even more alarming than anything. You know, the guy knows how to take care of his body, but maybe he doesn't know how to take care of it for baseball.
Well, and let's be fair. This probably means that in 2 years he can be the fire plug that starts the team, because you're basically describing Tommy Pham's career.
No kidding.
You know, I mean, that's what Tommy Pham spent a lot of time with, dealing with, was injuries and things of that nature. You know, I don't know that we can compare Pham to Grichuk. I'm not really doing that, but... You never know. I kind of think it back, it's sadly before your time, but not before Allen's. Back when Paul Molitor was a young player, he got hurt a lot. And then it came to a point where he just stopped. He started being healthy, and, you know, and I mean, he was good while he was hurt, but, you know, he became a Hall of Famer because he was actually able to stay on the field. And maybe there are just some players that are like that. They're hurt. They're trying to do too much as a young person. They don't really know their body just right, and they finally figure it out, and it all clicks. And, you know, maybe it's just random luck. I think that's something, I mean, who knows? I know the Cardinals in the past have talked about trying to be somewhat on the cutting edge of health and medical diagnosis and things like that, and while nobody wants to give them a whole lot of credit for the medical staff right now, you know, maybe that's the direction that they're going to move into now that John Mozeliak is, you know, the big picture guy. I don't know, but I don't know. It's kind of interesting just to see this struggle. And again, it just gets to, of course, it maybe just gets to the point where it's a little easier to cut him if they're just going to have to continue to deal with these issues. What do you think, Alan?
Well, yeah, it's funny. I was looking at the 40-man whenever Kyle was asking about, you know, the promotions and all that stuff. And I wonder if they're not going to do something drastic like that. You know, because they have already once this year to where it's like, you know, they're pulling the trigger and maybe some way to clean stuff out. I don't know. They think so highly of him, you know. And the thing is, I do too. I'm actually pro Grichuk over Piscotty. But you're right. It's just little ailments all the time, and you know, I just don't know. But if it's an injury deal, you'd think they would have given up on Pham a year or two ago as well. Probably more last year when he went out early, and we didn't see him until about the All-Star break. So, you know, I don't know. It doesn't seem to be their style generally, but it seems like they've lost a little bit of patience this year on stuff like that.
Well, and they typically, I mean, like with Pham, the only thing that saved him and maybe the only thing that saves Grichuk right now is having options. I think they really like to have those guys that they can send up and down if necessary. Pham had another option this year. If Pham had not had an option, you know, what do they do in spring training? They might have released him, and that would have been disastrous. You know, Grichuk has an option for the rest of this year, so he may be safe for this year, but next year, I don't know. You know, let's talk a little bit about, you know, the Wong move, because, you know, we knew he was coming back. We knew he was healthy, and it's a good thing for the Cardinals to have Colton Wong on the team. But, you know, Kyle, we've talked, I know Alan and I have talked about this a number of times. This roster clog doesn't get better with that. You know, now you've got Luke Voit in the, you know, Matt Adams honorary pinch hitting role. You know, is that, and you know better about Voit than we do, especially. I know he's not a, you know, guy that really needs to develop, but I still feel like he needs more than just, you know, 6 or 7 at-bats a week.
Yeah, so we might have made a comment before recording about some brilliant things that Al Hrabowski says every once in a while. But, you know, during the broadcast tonight, Al Hrabowski says, you know, it's that stupid false narrative that, oh, Voit's older. He's 26 years old. You know, he's not a kid. He doesn't need at-bats the way that a kid does. Well, any level that you get to for the first time, you need as many at-bats as possible to acclimate yourself to that. You know, if they would have brought, you know, whatever it was, when they would have brought Matt Adams up, if Matt Adams wouldn't have played every day, if he was working in a pinch-hitting role exclusively, or, you know, getting 2 starts every seven games, it would not have worked out. It would have worked out worse than it worked out, you know, up to this point for Matt Adams as a Cardinal. You need at-bats and reps at the level as you advance to it. If not, there's no possible way you can adjust. To me, it's just that simple. You know, the only way that works is if you don't expect anything out of Luke Voit. If all you want him to do is be a pinch hitter. And the Cardinals aren't in that position. The Cardinals need, because their roster is such an unusual, is so unusually constructed with so many parts that are kind of, you know, at positions and hitting in spots that they're not comfortable with or not used to. They need to ride the hot hand more than anything because they don't have a big bat in the middle of the order. So the hot hand becomes the most important part of the roster at any given moment. And Luke Voit was the hot hand. Paul DeJong, those guys are the hot hands. Those guys need to play as often as they can until their hand gets cold. So to me, you know, like you said, I love that Colton Wong's back. He's turned me into a believer. I was one of his naysayers at the beginning of the year, and I've been so impressed with the way he's conducted himself and played and all that stuff. But we're just in the same position we were at the beginning of the year, where there's a lot of guys who maybe aren't, you know, holding their own. And the rosters and the lineup and where they're playing in the field, it just seems like a total mess, a total cluster. And, you know, it's not something that's going to sort itself out.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. And, you know, it does feel like, I mean, I know that the Cardinals don't have expectations of Voit to be, you know, the starting first baseman for the next 5-10 years. I mean, but it does feel like he can be more than just a guy that, you know, you know, every once in a while comes up and hits the long ball. And like you said, if he doesn't get those at-bats, that long ball is not going to happen nearly as often. As the league gets a chance to adjust to him, but he doesn't have a chance to adjust to the league. And that's why I thought, you know, this coming up week when they goes play the Mets again, the first team that he would have seen twice, it would have been a pretty good test to see how much they're adjusting, how much he's adjusting. But, you know, now we won't see that. I mean, Alan, you know, we've talked about it. This whole roster turns on Matt Carpenter,
mm-hmm.
for good or ill. And again, Matt Carpenter's a good player, but you start to wonder, is he holding up, you know, the sum of the pieces?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, I ask that a lot. I mean, and his, you know, offensive numbers, Carpenter's right there with his, you know, his career norms. You know, he's a great hitter. You just wish there was more flexibility in the field. And I know that's what you're asking. I'm just, mm-hmm. it's just bizarre how much it kind of locks them down a little bit. And, you know, and I agree with you. It's one of those to where I like that Voight's up for the story and the potential, but it's not going to happen if he's going to play, if he's not going to play much. And I don't know if he needs to play in place of Colton Wong. Because I, Kyle, I'm just like you. I really was surprised that Wong was a Cardinal this long. And now I'm a believer. I mean, I think he needs to be in the lineup every day. So I don't know. I mean, it goes back to just what you guys were saying. The roster is just so bizarre the way that they've put it together, to where they need guys to play and they've handcuffed their ability to do so and be effective.
Yeah, I mean it's weird because again we talk about the offense and we talk about this team needing something, but then you look around and it's like, well, if Matt Carpenter doesn't play first. You know, well, you got Luke Voight, he can play first. Well, if you know, you got Colton Wong at second, you got Jed Jerko at third, and all these places that Matt Carpenter can play are taken by players that can at least challenge him or at least be adequate if he's not there. So, but, you know, you've got to figuring out how to play all this. And again, it kind of feels like, you know, some managers would be better than others at rotating four guys through three positions or whatever the case may be. But I don't think anybody has a whole lot of confidence that Mike Matheny's going to be that guy. And, you know, when Matt Carpenter is supposedly your cornerstone hitter, it's hard to sit him even one in every 4 days, isn't it?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I don't know. I mean, it's a problem. And that, I know that we'll probably lead into this in a little bit. I don't know what direction they could go. They're really painting themselves in a corner.
Yeah, it kind of feels like that as well. And we'll shift to that last spot. Luke Weaver goes down. Kevin Segrist comes up. And Kyle, I know you have probably had a chance to see Segrist as he's been in his rehab assignments, but from all reports, all indications, that rehab assignment didn't really go well.
Yeah, he looked terrible. His velocity was down. He didn't have any bite on any of his breaking pitches. There's no deception. You know, he's always been a reverse split guy, and lefties. There was a beautiful one out double that drove in two runs against them in his last rehab appearance in Springfield. You know, he gets beat around. He doesn't have control. There's no deception. His velocity's down. I asked, because I was tweeting about it, I had a few people inquire about what was going on. And, you know, I don't know why. And let me rephrase that. I know why you'd keep going to him out of loyalty and all that other stuff. Like, I get the reasoning behind it. I don't agree with it, but I get the reasoning behind it. But I don't know why you would expect different results when none of the attributes that he had when he was successful are there now. None of them are there. He doesn't have the velocity. He doesn't have the movement. He doesn't have the control, the command. It's all gone. So, you know, Alan had a great line earlier about the one positive about tonight being Stephen Piscotty. Like, to me, it's going to sound crazy, but the one positive is that we didn't get to see Kevin Segrist. Every time that he doesn't come in is a positive, unless it's a blowout and you need some scrap innings and you want to put him in. Because to me, he is the most vulnerable arm in that pen right now. And I mean, I was demoralized. I watch him pitch okay in his first appearance in Springfield, and you could tell that he might have gotten lucky a couple times. The strike zone was a little weird, but that second appearance, it didn't matter what the count was. It didn't matter what he was throwing. The hitters were making hard contact. And, you know, he's compromised. I don't know what you even do with him at this point. My thought was that you would keep him down. You know, pitchers get 30 days on a rehab. Hitters get 20 days. And I thought, keep him down there as long as possible. You don't have a reason to bring him up. Let him work out stuff. And, you know, they went with him anyways, and I'm sure that that's out of veteran loyalty more than anything.
Well, and Alan, that's what I was going to ask next. What is the idea? I mean, I get, like Kyle said, I get veteran loyalty, and I understand that. But I also understand that this organization, at least for the most part, is pretty smart about this stuff, and there's no reason to rush. Not only did Sechrist have, you know, probably, what, another 20 days on that rehab assignment, but he also has a minor league option. I mean, you could send him, you could even have him down there for a little bit of time. I mean, what's the thinking here? Especially with a guy like Zach Duke, who is pitching well and could be ready very soon. Lefties are going to be, like, overwhelming in the bullpen with Sechrist up. What's the rush?
Well, and that's a great point. That's where I was going to go with my answer. It was, of the lefties that I thought were going to get pulled up, I know they were going to keep three regardless, but I thought it was going to be Duke and not Sechrist. So it surprised me when I got the message saying that it was Sechrist getting the call, because I'd heard the same. Well, I'd probably heard from you, Kyle, that he just looked terrible. So I don't know. Cecil's probably your best reliever right now. Lyons has his point. Like, Lyons probably comes in the fifth tonight, don't you guys think? And probably pitches quite a bit, other than maybe a bridge inning from Sechrist like they would have done. Mm-hmm. But getting back to it, they're definitely not going to need four. So are they going to see what Sechrist can do until Duke's ready? I could see that happening. I thought that promotion was very bizarre, and then the way that they handled Weaver was bizarre. So, I just don't know. I don't know what's going on. I just feel like there's – I've said this all year, though. There's a lot of moving pieces right now, but I just don't know where that's going to end up, because I really thought before now we would have some clarity on what they were going to do. I don't even think they know what they're going to do yet. So I don't know. It's a head scratcher all the way around.
Yeah, and Kyle, what is the deal? What is the deal with Luke Weaver? I mean that seemed very weird to send down a guy that's, you know, and maybe that's the idea is with all these relievers, they don't need a long man, and that's, he's better pitching on a regular routine down in Memphis. But it seemed like a weird swap to take a guy that's, you know, 2-3 inning kind of guy that can pitch and fill in if Waka starts to blow up or somebody else does, and replace him with a guy in Sechrist that at best is going to be an inning guy.
Yeah, and it was even more unusual because Weaver was doing everything that you needed him to do. Mm-hmm. Out of the role that they were using him. You know, I've watched a lot of Luke Weaver. I made a point to watch all of his starts, as many of his starts as I could over the last 2 years, and it's the most simple thing with him, and maybe it sounds like a kind of a cop-out because you could say this about all pitchers, but with him in particular, if he can keep the ball low in the zone, he's dominant. He's not good, he's dominant, and he's worked in a cutter that's helping his fastball and change. He's I forgot what the exact term is, but it's like a drag and drop pitcher, so he gets low, pushes and drives. There aren't a lot of pitchers like that, and that's why it's important he has to stay down in the zone. Well, he was doing that out of the pen. You know, his first appearance this season, he came up, he was a little shaky at the get-go. Yadi came out, talked to him, set him right. He had another appearance, he was great. Yeah, the only thing I can think of with Weaver is maybe, and you know, he missed a little time with injury, but maybe they brought him up in this particular instance as a means to save his innings a little bit. Just in case, you know, just in case they trade Lance Lynn, and all right, we don't have to worry about Luke Weaver pitching into October. If they get a chance to pitch in October, like that, we've already taken care of that. That's planned ahead. But it had a really interesting effect on the system in general, because on Weaver's day to pitch in Memphis was Zach Gallen's day to pitch in Springfield, and Dakota Hudson had pitched the day before. So Dakota Hudson, who was probably most ready for a promotion to Memphis, had to get passed over. They brought up Zach Gallen, who had only had a handful of starts at Springfield. And he pitched really, really well in Memphis, better than he should have. And, you know, the next chain reaction is now that Weaver's back in Memphis, that pushes Gallen back to Springfield. And it's kind of a weird to demote those guys after they both pitched well in the roles that you needed them to, that was even weird to me. Other than the reason that I just gave, I can't think of another reason why it was handled the way it was handled.
Is there a possibility, and I'm just thinking this out right now, so this probably doesn't make any reasonable sense, but, I mean, did they maybe want to send Weaver down to make a couple of starts to, you know, help with his trade value? You know, again, most people should know what Weaver is and know what he can do, but, you know, maybe it's to prove to their trading partners that they don't see him as a bullpen arm. You know, again, I think that's a lot of reach, but, you know, maybe there's something there.
Yeah, that's an interesting thought. I guess the only like counterpoint I have to that, and I think you're on to something. I could see that logic, but my only counterpoint to that is he's been so good at Memphis this year, and I don't know if you can actually get any better than he's been at Memphis. And I just, like, I look at that, and you're right. You send him back down, you prove that he can start. You prove that he can start every 5 days. But can he pitch any better than he's pitched? Yep. And I don't think anyone's capable of pitching any better than he's pitched at that level.
Well, and to counter that, then, not really to counter it, but to go along with, is maybe you send him down so he doesn't get roughed up in the big leagues, and he keeps his average. If he's dominating Memphis, send him back where he's dominating. That keeps his trade value up instead of, you know, a bad day. Because, you know, with a relief appearance, he could have one bad, you know, a bloop and a blast, and all of a sudden he looks like he's, you know, a quad A player. Not really, but you know what I'm saying. He takes a hit to his trade value.
All of a sudden he looks like Soon Wan Oh against lefties.
Well, let's not go that far.
Sorry. No, that's a terrific point. No, you're 100% correct that it just goes to show you how tough of a decision it is and how much of a juggling act it is. That's great. I love that counterpoint for sure.
Yeah. And I guess, I mean, and you look at this roster, and I don't know who else goes down to some degree too. I mean, we may be just overthinking it. I mean, Tua Lavalla has pitched pretty well. You know, I don't think you're going to send down Brevia. You know, looking at it, I think that's pretty much, I mean, Bowman's pitch, well, obviously, Bowman is not allowed to get without, you know, 50 yards of Mike Matheny. I mean, that, you know, Mike Matheny went with Bowman on the All-Star break just to make sure he could throw a couple times.
I love that.
So, I mean, I guess to some degree, maybe it was more of just somebody had to go and that was who it was going to be. But again, you didn't have to bring Kevin Seager's up. So, I mean, you could have just left Luke Weaver up here and not had a problem. So it's really weird. And I think that it's some of those things, Alan, that we, this time of year, we try to read into everything that happens because the trade deadline's coming. And maybe we try to do too much that way.
Oh, yeah, I'm the worst about that. I mean, I've texted both of you guys going, okay, now what happens if this happens and this? What direction are they going to go? And, you know, I overanalyze it so much, especially they're doing part of what they said they were going to do, and they're going to try every combination to try to get things right, to get the plan better. But that's not what we want to hear. You know, we want to see something to come in to help, and we know how difficult it is, and it takes two in that situation. So, and we know that it's hard, but still, some of these moves that you're just like, that didn't make a whole lot of sense. I would love to be able to talk to Mozeliak or Gersh after the season, kind of like we did mid-season. You know, I would like to hear their stories about why they did what they did, because I'm sure there's a story behind it. It just doesn't make a lot of sense.
To be fair, to point, usually after the season we do get a chance to submit email questions to. In the past it's been Mo. I don't know who will. Now, doesn't mean he'll answer it, but you know, we do have a chance to ask those questions
at
the end of the year usually. So I will continue to try to work for that again. But yeah, you're right. I think that's kind of interesting to see how much they can even. Yeah, and some of that they can't, you know, can't even tell you afterwards. But it will be interesting to see maybe what their thinking was at that time. Let's pause for a moment in all this other Cardinal stuff. Let's go ahead and talk about the All-Star game just a little bit, since that was this week. And the Cardinals had a significant impact on that game. Carlos Martinez pitched two innings. I think he's the only NL pitcher to pitch two innings, struck out four batters. Yadier Molina did pretty much everything, including take pictures, which was, you know, interesting. home run, he took a walk, almost scored, could have, you know, could have possibly scored the winning run. Dressed up as his favorite Star Wars character. You know, it was a big day for Yachty. Kyle, did you watch the game? And if so, what did you think about really this laid-back presentation that they had this year?
You know, I'll tell you one thing I liked, and I've had a really busy week. I watched most of the game. I didn't watch all of it. But I did like that they used the exhibition to get a chance to talk to players in-game.
I agree with that.
That was so cool. I wish that there was a way to do that during a real game. Like, even if it's in between innings where a guy's playing catch out in the outfield, and I know that's probably a terrible idea. Yeah, I would love to see that translated into a regular broadcast where it doesn't compromise a player's concentration during the game. And not like one of those terrible dugout interviews where the players play with each other and you ask, "Hey, Bueno, how you doing today? How was the heat, Bueno? Last night." Like, that's fun and fine, and it's killing time, and I get it. But, like, that was really, really interesting to me, you know? And Yachty 3PO was probably my favorite part of the entire thing. That's so funny.
I love it. It was awesome when he came out in that.
Yeah, so I thought it was good. I like that we didn't have to worry about who was going to field advantage. That was great, and that's my thoughts.
Well, and Alan, I mean, you continued. I know you were saying the same thing. It did seem to be a chance. I think baseball made it to try to showcase who these players actually are on a bigger stage.
Yeah, and I think there's a bit more. Or I think there was a little bit of, I don't like the face of the sport type situation that everybody tries to promote. Like, there's the one face, whatnot. I did think they tried to humanize the guys a little bit. And I thought Springer's interview was great. Yeah. Right after a ball gets hit right at him, the timing was perfect. And then they get to go through it a little bit more. I thought the A-Rod in the infield, I thought that would be a little bit better, because I honestly thought he would be out there. Like, I was hoping Cozart would take a grounder while he was out there, you know, between innings. You know, one of those type situations. So that didn't do as much to me. But I do like how they try to humanize the guys. I really like that. I know that the very first thing that I saw was, man, this is stupid. I hate that they're doing this. And I was like, if it's an exhibition, I want them to really pump this part of it up. And I really liked it.
Yeah, I will say, you know, they had the interviews with the leadoff batters. I didn't think that was that was kind of silly. I mean,
well, you could tell that the leadoff, that they weren't ready for it. They're just like, we're not used to this. You know, both of them were kind of shell shocked, because, like, Blackman, he's one of those guys that's never a loss for words, and he couldn't come up with it with an answer to what Verducci asked him. And I was like, I just don't think he was prepared for this.
Yeah, and A-Rod around the infield was okay. It was a little bit better. But yeah, the you know, talking to Springer and Harper while they're actually playing the game was very interesting. And like you said, I think with Springer they did a little bit more of, you know, can you see the pitches? Can you, you know, how are you shifting? And you can't get overly technical on a stage that is definitely designed for the casual fans to be involved to, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, some of that inside baseball stuff is interesting. You know, I'm not one of the Bryce Harper haters, you know, but he didn't have to bring up football. I mean, come on. It's your night. Don't talk about football. I mean, come on.
Yeah.
But anyway.
Can I break in with some good news for the night, though?
What's that?
The Orioles just tied the Cubs at 8.
There we go.
After being down 8-0.
Yeah, and we'll get to their move probably here in a little bit as well, but it's obvious that they didn't solve all their pitching problems.
Well, that's the beauty of it, because I was like, when they were up 8-0, I was like, okay, now this is where they're going to take off after the deal yesterday. So this is one of those that could be more of a ripping your heart out than it was for the Cardinals tonight.
That's true. I'd rather have lost, I think, 3-2 than been up 8-0 and lost.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, yeah, so the All-Star game went well. I think we're just going to see a lot more of these extra inning 2-1 type games where everybody's striking out 15 times a game. Because when you can take the best pitchers in the game and tell them they're only going to throw one inning, I mean, Max Scherzer, I mean, how he didn't throw it through somebody is impressive. And, you know, Carlos, you know, Joe Schwartz, you know, had and completely great credit to him, had that idea of, you know, trying to get pledges for people that were going to donate $102 to Tsunami Waves if Carlos hit 102 on the radar gun, and, you know, Carlos hit, what, 101.4 or something like that, and still raised, you know, $5,000 or something for the charity, which was incredible for the fact that, as far as I know, it was just spur of the moment, you know, idea on Joe's part. So you got to really give him a lot of credit for that. But it was just, you know, I mean, Carlos was still, he knew he wasn't pitching the whole game. He could go out and throw it. And as good as the hitters are these days, you know, if you get different angles, different looks, and they're throwing 100-something miles an hour, there's not going to be a whole heck of a lot of offense.
Yeah, no, it was impressive, and I thought Martinez's innings were really impressive, and I thought that he needed it after the last two starts being bad, just to go out there and throw without pressure and then throw heat. I thought it was impressive.
Yeah, and it will be able to see if that will help him maybe get settled in here. He'll pitch on Sunday against Pirates, so hopefully that'll straighten him out a little bit. All right. Well, as we've referenced, the Cubs make their move today, getting Jose Quintana from the White Sox. Or maybe that was yesterday. I guess it was yesterday. Days run together. Kind of kicking off this first salvo of things. The Brewers have not, you know, they're going to probably do something. I don't know that they're going to make a huge move, just because I don't think they really plan to contend this year. They're not going to necessarily upend their plans to try to win this year. Kyle, does the Quintana move and the rumors that the Cubs are apparently looking at Sonny Gray as well, one, does that put the Cubs in the driver's seat even if they're 5.5 back? And two, does that force the Cardinals' hand a little bit?
Yeah. So Sonny Gray is interesting to me because he, you know, there might be something seriously wrong with that arm, and that's a fair speculation. It's not one of these other guys been hobbling. Like, there might be something seriously wrong with that guy's arm. I know that if I was a general manager of a team, I'd stay away from it. Quintana's interesting because, you know, he's an advanced analytics dream. Everyone, you know, all the advanced metrics people love him. I understand that. He's had some really, really great seasons. I don't necessarily know. So here's the thing. We were talking about it on Twitter again tonight. I think about that Oakland A's team from a couple years back when they traded Addison Russell to the Cubs and they got Samardzija and Hamill back. And then later on, they traded Cespedes for John Lester. Now, their big issue was pitching, and they needed more pitching. And Samardzija wasn't exactly lights out, and Hamill was terrible after he got traded to Oakland. But to me, Quintana's a lot like Samardzija was then. And Hamill is kind of like Sonny Gray. Of course, Sonny Gray has a better pedigree than Hamill had at that point. He has better stuff. He can be a front-of-the-rotation pitcher. But there's still so many question marks there. And Quintana's taking a step back. And I don't think that these are the moves that solve all their ills. Their problem for 2 years has been bullpen. You know, their bullpen was the thing that the fan base was worried about last year. They did tweak it a little bit, but I wouldn't necessarily say they got better this year. That the bullpen there still needs to get fixed. They haven't done anything to do, you know, to really work on that. You know, Wade Davis is great except for in All-Star games, and yeah, I don't think that totally solves all their problems. I getting to the Cardinal side of that. I've listened to enough of John Mozeliak over the last, what feels like 100 years, but it's only 10 years. And if there's one thing I feel comfortable in knowing is that they won't necessarily get reactionary in these circumstances. You know, my hope is that they're sticking hard to that 4 to 6 week outline that they set for themselves. They're not necessarily letting the baseball world and how it orbits you know, like affect how they make their decisions. I hopefully they're looking at everything in their own personal vacuum and not the vacuum of baseball. Mazalek, you know, I don't know Gersh well enough. I don't know Mazalek well enough, but I feel like I do. Where, you know, I feel like I know Mo well enough that he won't let this dictate his next move. They've always been the kind of team that only lets the issues within the organization dictate their moves. And that's one thing that I admire. And I hope they stick that way, because right now going out and trading for Sonny Gray to prevent the Cubs from trading for him would be, in my opinion, you know, the absolute worst move that they can make. And it's not a move mm-hmm. that I think is on their radar, but I don't think that that's something that'll happen.
Yeah,
I agree. I wanted, don't get me wrong, I really like Quintana, where some people didn't. But I thought he would be a good fit as a Cardinal just because of the control and being left-handed. And I thought that the Cardinals could get away with the deal if you couldn't. I thought that would be the one where Kelly would probably go. But I didn't want to lose Reyes to do it. That was kind of how I felt. So whenever I actually saw that the Cubs had done it, before even looking at who the trade, the return was, I was like, well, this is going to help the Cubs because he's controllable, but it could screw them because they could be looking at a situation right now. If they gamble, which I think they're going to do, and give away some guys, yeah, they may be really good for here for another year or two. They could be looking at a 5-year plan where the outlook is not very good. Because now they're starting to lose some of those prospects that they held, and they've graduated so many to the big leagues now that they may have backed themselves into a corner. I'm curious to see how that works because, you know, I think that they have the money to play to where they say Arrieta's not coming back, but they could roll the dice on that, and they may not want him back. Their rotation still isn't that good. So I'm not sure if that helps them that much immediately, but I really think it hurts them in the long run. Whenever they make this deal, the Gray situation may even make it worse. Now, I've got a theory on Gray, though. And if the next player that gets traded off there is going to be Baez. The reason it'll probably be Russell. And the reason I do say that is kind of the same reason. They may be distancing themselves from Russell a little bit with the off the field issues that they may have to deal with him. So I'm thinking there could be more to this. On these trades, and I'm all about them trading guys off their big league roster.
Oh yeah, I mean, at all. The only problem with Russell is, like you say, you don't, even with the off field stuff, it makes it less likely that another team is going to want him. So you know, how much do you want to sell so low? You know, maybe it's worth it, maybe it's not. I don't know. It's going to be interesting. It will be interesting to see. Yeah, I don't think that the Cardinals go out and try to block the Cubs from making a move.
Agreed.
But you do figure that the Quintana thing fits into the calculus. Like we said, this team is sitting right on that balance point of, do you try to get something and make a move for this year? Do you, you know, get rid of Lance Lynn and you know, maybe Trevor Rosendahl, try to bring some pieces in? Do you try to do, you know, strike some middle road? And with the Cubs getting better, you know, maybe that pushes them a little bit closer to the sell point. And a game like tonight doesn't help that either. And I don't know. You know, we keep talking about the offense, but this team, besides the fact that you're going to have to trade off the major league roster to find room for anybody, besides the fact that we keep talking about adding Giancarlo Stanton, even though we have 872 outfielders in the organization.
Yeah.
Which, granted, none of them are Giancarlo Stanton either, but still. You know, could the Cardinals go a different route? Could the Cardinals go for Zach Britton? Out, because apparently if his name's started to come up, you know, if they get him and solidify the back end of the rotation, or the bullpen, you know, and go out and find some sort of mid-level arm, you know, can they contend? I don't know. I think we're getting fixated on that middle of the order bat because they need it, and they need it for years to come, but I don't know how much they need it mm-hmm. this year.
And here's the thing about that. I know that I've talked to both of you about this situation, and I've gone through all the rosters, and to look, the bat that's going to play and is going to get the fan base, what the fan base wants to see, that guy's not coming here midseason. You know, because those guys are in contention still. Yeah. You're not going to get that pivotal bat, especially the one that's controllable. You know, I don't know. We're going to throw out 10 names. Most of those are going to be hard to get. So to back up your point on that, Daniel, I wonder if they're not going to build pitching and defense and roll the dice on the offense. That's kind of what I was going to bring that point up a little bit later. But it wouldn't surprise me if they go and, you know, I hate to say this because if they were to go and play for 1 year get a rental in Addison Reed, but you have to take Cabrera with it, because would not surprise me if they went and got a veteran shortstop at this point. You know, we kind of talked about some of the names that kind of fit that, and even those guys are hard to get. But, you know, I don't know. I just feel like I think they're going to stand pat before they get the bat that's going to make people happy, the ones that everybody wants to see, because I just don't think those are going to be available.
Kyle, where are you landing on this thing?
Yeah, I've been – I don't want them to make a move for anyone. I want them, you know, unless it's a controllable middle of the order bat and Alan Nails, none of those guys exist. And Giancarlo Stanton, there's no way of telling what his trade value is. Mm-hmm. Yeah, with the opt out clause, and it's almost like if you trade for him, he either needs to sign saying that, you know, he will honor all the contract, or sign saying he will opt out right now. That's the only way that the Marlins can even begin to understand his value, and that's the only way that the team that trades for him can even understand his value. Like, there would have to be an agreement there immediately upon trade, which isn't out of the question, but it's something that could happen. I think step one is you trade Lynn. There's no reason not to trade Lynn at this point. That's just my own personal belief. You know, even if you end up making a run, Lance Lynn is a great player, and he interviews better than any human being on earth. And he does all of those things, but he's not a difference maker. You're not talking about a top of the rotation arm. You're talking about a middle of the rotation arm who's still going to ebb and flow because he's coming back from Tommy John surgery. You know, that needs to be step one. See what you get from him as a return. You know, Quintana's different because he has years of control and a modest contract, relatively speaking. So you're not looking at that, but I definitely think, you know, a Dylan Cease, a player of that caliber, is a good, and you know, maybe one of the other two prospects that were involved in the Eloy Jimenez, Jose Quintana deal, the two of those guys, that's the kind of package you're looking at for Lance Lynn, in my opinion. And you make that trade, and then from there you reevaluate. You put Luke Weaver right in the rotation. If he struggles, you put Jack Flaherty in the rotation. They have options, but I don't see the need to buy. I think Ellen brought up a really interesting thing. They've been vocal, both Gersh and Mozeliak, in the last couple of weeks have been vocal about saying that they're looking for a shortstop, which means that they're looking for a shortstop. That means that none of us should be surprised if in 2 weeks they have a new shortstop. I know that, you know, Ellen, I know you and I have talked about Reed before as a relief option too. They definitely need another relief option. There's a real chance they're going to have four left-handed arms in a bullpen in the near future. That's not going to work. I don't think it's going to work, at least. But I think that's a really good direction to look in, look towards the Mets and what they're selling. If they add, it'll be something like that, because there aren't real options out there for them for what they need.
Yeah, And let's use this now to transition into that last segment that we're going to talk about, which is our now that we have our supreme overlord of prospects with us, we'll talk about the minor leagues. And let's, before we get into what's going on there, though, let's talk about the players. I mean, in general, who is there? And again, I know that we're saying this in general, because if somebody offered Mike Trout, anybody's on the table. But in general, who are the prospects that you think are basically untouchable? And who do you think has the most value that might get traded?
I really do. You know, I think it would take a special player for them to trade Delvin Perez. I wouldn't call him untouchable. I don't think he's untouchable. But I think if the Cardinals thought that they could get a controlled young player at a modest contract for him, I think they'd roll the dice. I don't know who that player is. I really don't. But I still think Alex Reyes is untouchable. And sure, in 2 weeks I'll look like a complete jerk for saying it when he gets traded for Mike Trout straight up. But
well, it would have to be Trout or Arenado for me to be happy on that deal.
Yeah.
Yeah, or Machado, right?
Yeah, or Machado. Maybe.
Yeah, none of that's going to happen. Let me ask you, if it ended up being Delvin Perez and you know, two of the top 10 prospects in the system for Stanton and all of Stanton's contract, would you do that?
Boy,
I don't know. That's tough for me. I don't think so.
Not if you're paying the whole contract. I think that, you know, again, there's been some talk about the Marlins eating some of that to get a better prospect, and that's a different equation. But if you're paying for the whole $325 million that you might be on the hook for, or whatever that's left if you go all the way out and he doesn't opt out, you can't be giving up your top guys for that. I mean, that's just, he's not so good that, the contract's a bargain.
I agree. I completely agree. So I think Delvin Perez and Alex Reyes obviously are the two guys with the most trade value, even Alex Reyes coming off of Tommy John surgery. I've been trying to figure out how to, correlate that. And I keep thinking, over the last couple of years, guys have been taken in the first round early. Like, I think of Jeff Hoffman for Colorado. He was a top 20 pick. I don't remember exactly where he went. He was just coming off of Tommy John, and he went in the first round. So that should go to show you, Alex Reyes, his value has not diminished, if at all. If it is, it's just the least amount. I would still think that, the only way – I can't imagine Alex Reyes getting traded. I think Delvin Perez probably has the most value in the system. And obviously Jack Flaherty boosted his stock more than any of us ever could have imagined. I mean, I think – I wrote about it at the preseason top 30 that we did at Redbird Daily, that I thought he would have a rebound year. I didn't think it'd be anything like this, where he's totally dominant. But, I would imagine that any team, if the Cardinals were to buy, any team that's looking at just prospects in the organization will start with those three names. And, Carson Kelly's another name, but that's another interesting, another interesting thing going on. Alan and I were direct messaging each other back and forth this week during John Vooch's interview with Frank Cusumano here in St. Louis on 590. Everyone keeps pushing this timeshare that's going to happen in between Carson Kelly and Yadier Molina over the next couple of years. I do think that's what the Cardinals want to try, so I don't think Carson Kelly is a trade piece, so maybe he's off the table this year. But, things could change next year or the year after that, depending on how the catcher timeshare goes. But yeah, I mean, the most value is exactly who you would expect it to be. It's Delvin and it's Alex Reyes and Jack Flaherty, and then everyone else is kind of like a B level prospect after those three.
Okay, so let's take a look at this system. I know you just re-ranked your top 31 from the beginning of the season. Highlights of that. I mean, who was the fast riser? Who was the drop off, and who surprised you?
Yeah, Oscar Mercado. The fastest riser was Oscar Mercado. What he's been able to do this year is incredible. He went from not even being remotely ranked. He wasn't considered for best of the rest. He was dismissed by everyone. The only time I can find anyone who wrote about him was, again, I'll pat myself on the back as supreme overlord of all prospects, but in the offseason, I wrote about Mozeliak's, the worst draft picks of Mozeliak's tenure, and I put him down as an honorable mention because he had been so terrible, but I thought he might be able to turn it around because after he got turned into a center fielder, his stats started ticking up. I didn't expect anything near what he's done. He's slashing 300+, 360+, 800+ as an OPS, and what he's been able to do in transitioning to center field. We brought him up earlier as part of the dynamic trio outfield of him, Sierra, and Arozarena. Him as the anchor in center field, he really is – he's going to stay in center field. He hurt his shoulder. He just came off the DL 3 games ago. He's still hitting the ball hard, but you can tell he's struggling just a little bit to get his timing back. I'll be anxious to see how he adapts to that. But he looks every bit like a legitimate center fielder in the major leagues. And, you know, he has stolen base, the ability to steal bases that Sierra doesn't have, and he has power that Sierra doesn't have. So it's really interesting to see how he'll develop. He's definitely the fast riser. The big faller is the guy who fell off the worst. He was my 17th rated prospect, was Ronnie Williams, pitching in Peoria. He went from a lot of people thinking that he was working his way into the top 15, maybe even top 10 in the Cardinals organization, right-handed pitcher. He got off to a terrible start in Peoria. I believe it was 7 starts into the season they moved him to the bullpen. He's been terrible out of the bullpen. He tweeted a couple things that were suspect and then immediately erased them about, you know, fighting or being disrespected, and that's not good. That's no bueno. So, you know, he doesn't necessarily pump up the velocity. There's a lot of, like, his he profiles similar to how Terrell Jenkins profiled. You know, he walks maybe too many guys. He lets up too many home runs. He doesn't necessarily throw with enough velocity. He doesn't necessarily have a repertoire that's going to help him as he progresses, but he was going to be good in the minors. Some guys are just that way. So he was the big drop off. And, you know, if I go more than 15 minutes at this point, while talking about prospects and the Cardinals system, and I don't bring up Randy or Rosarena, that I'm doing it wrong. he is incredible, and getting a chance to really watch him in Springfield, he is so impressive. You know, he took Twitter by storm, Cardinal Twitter by storm, when he turned a pop up, an infield pop up into a triple. But you know, it was an error and all that other nonsense. But that isn't impressive. That's fun to talk about, and it's a cool thing to see. Last night, he turned a gap double into a stand-up triple. He doesn't, like, that's impressive to me. That's what I want to see. That other stuff's novelty. That other stuff is water cooler banter. Like, I want to see that, because you don't see that. You don't see that at the major league level. You don't see that at the minor league level, even for guys who are trying to make a name for themselves. And, you know, I'm not going to say that he was pumping it all the way out of the box, but that goes to show you what kind of athleticism this guy has, what kind of speed he has when he gets rolling, because he wasn't pumping it out of the box. He took a look at it, got about 40, 50 feet down the line, and then pumped it and still had a stand-up triple. Like, he is pure athleticism, and he has – I wrote about it in the preseason rankings. He has just the most beautiful swing that can go to both gaps. It's meant to go to both gaps. And he doesn't get cheated when he swings either. He swings full throttle every time, which is my one major concern with him. I'm concerned that as he gets to Memphis in the major leagues, that some pitchers with really good breaking pitches and off-speed stuff will be able to victimize him with the heavy-hearted the heavy swing he takes. But he doesn't get cheated, and that's why he's hitting for power now. He's right at 8 home runs, and 7 of those came in Palm Beach, and for a guy his size to hit 7 home runs in the pitcher-friendly, wind-swirling league that is the Florida State League at Roger Dean Stadium, which is the toughest stadium to hit in maybe all of minor league baseball, it cannot be understated how impressive that is. So, you know, to me, he's the most impressive. I wrote about it today in our weekly awards that I think if I were to do it over again and it would be an emotional change, I would flip him and Mags. I would flip him and Magnuris. Magnuris was my number 7th ranked prospect. Rosarena was my number 14. I would probably flip them, and I would probably put Sierra behind Mercado too, just because Mercado has the full range of skills that haven't necessarily manifest themselves with Sierra yet. Those would be covering the tops, the bottoms, and, you know, my substitute Luis Robert.
You always got to find another hobby horse, for sure. I thought the most interesting thing about the triple, pop-up triple for me, was not the speed that he showed, which was obviously very impressive, but just the heads-up baseball knowledge to realize that, you know, nobody's covering third, I can keep going. You know, and the ability, to, of course, to beat everybody there. But, you know, it's just that heads-up base running that, you know, honestly, we haven't seen just a whole lot. In that regard, I guess it's kind of like Tommy Pham. It's just that, you know, that exciting mindset that we don't see very much of. So is there, I mean, obviously he's just now moving up the ladder. I mean, he's not, where is he going to wind up this season? Is he going to stay at Springfield the whole time?
I think unless things get really, really weird, I think you'll definitely see him stay at Springfield for the rest of the year. You never know exactly what's going to happen. You know, say that the Cardinals go for an upgrade and Harrison Bader gets traded, or Jose Dallas Garcia Jag gets traded, then, you know, I could see, I guess the logical step would be if Mags Sierra isn't on the major league roster, he would be. Can I call him Mags? Do you guys have a problem with me calling him Mags?
I have no problem.
So. All right. Yeah. Didn't bother me.
If Mr. Sierra, I'm just going to call him Mr. Sierra. I can't do it. If Mr. Sierra isn't on the major league roster, then I would imagine that he would be the next logical guy to take a spot on the Memphis outfield. But you know, things could get really unusual, and maybe either Mercado or Rosarena goes, but I would think a Rosarena is third on the depth chart of moves to Memphis. You know, I tweeted about it yesterday. If I'm a scout looking to trade with the Cardinals on a team that's selling to the Cardinals, I'm starting with Randy Arozarena. Like, if I'm going to get one of the outfielders, I'm pushing for him. I really am impressed with what Harrison Bader has done defensively, what he's done offensively too. He's made such huge strides from last year. I did not expect to ever say out loud that I thought Harrison Bader would be able to stay in center, and now I think he can. He's really maximized, like, he's maxed out all of his skills. But that's not the guy I would trade for. And Sierra, because he doesn't have any power, and he still is a little too aggressive for his other skill sets at the plate. And Mercado is still a question mark because you don't know if this is a flash in the pan or something that's going to stick. Arozarena is definitely one of the guys that I would target as a trade. And I can't imagine that if the Cardinals upgrade and that team is looking for an outfielder, that it's not going to be either Sierra or Arozarena.
Alan, you got any? Because I've got a few more, but I'll be nice and generous and let you have a shot at this. You got any questions for Kyle?
I'll let you go ahead and fire one more off. I may have one more before
okay.
we're done.
Well, and
I've got one that could be long is the issue. So,
well, you know us, we always hate long. I mean, we just never
Kyle
do that.
Prepared, I think Kyle may be prepared for the one that I'm going to ask.
Okay. Well, let me hit up then. I know one guy that fell on your list as a guy that I had been thinking about recently, and so I was interested to see that, and that's Bryce Denton. You know, I think what, last year's draft pick, or is it the year before?
He was 2015.
Okay. I know people were real high on him when he was drafted, but is there something that, I know he got demoted, is it just not clicking yet?
It was a weird start to the season for Bryce. I know that the reports out of minor league spring training were that they were really impressed with what he had shown. You know, he had transitioned from third base to the outfield. He has a really strong arm. You know, he profiles, in my opinion, best in right field. And then right at the beginning of the season, I think before he could even play a game, it might have been like the first couple games before the Peoria season fired up, he ended up having appendicitis. And I'm not sure if he had his appendix removed or not. I think he did. It's kind of a weird thing to speculate on. But he came down with a terrible case of appendicitis and almost missed all of April. So when he started in Peoria, there's a good chance, and it was rumored that he wasn't 100% healthy, and that showed in his play in Peoria. He was terrible in Peoria to start. He just couldn't get it together. So they sent him to extended spring training to get a few more swings underneath his belt. And when the state college season opened, he started in state college, which is a level below Peoria. It's a short season squad as opposed to Peoria, which is a full season squad. And he hasn't been able to put it together there either. He's starting to show some signs of coming out of it. He's had a couple multi-hit games over the last week, but it's just it's just a little off, which is heartbreaking for me because I was aggressive in ranking him in the preseason. And I still, the thing is, he's still only 19 years old. You know, he could still easily turn it around. I have to wonder how badly the appendectomy or the appendicitis messed with him. You know, granted, we're 3 months removed from that at this point, but, you know, it's disappointing to see him fall because I am a huge fan of his, and he's past the point now in this season where he can toil. You can't get demoted at 19 and perform just as poorly at the level you've been demoted to as the level you were at before the demotion. So he's definitely a concern and somebody I'm hoping that by the end of the year works his way back down to, you know, near the 20 number. Because right now I believe I have him ranked at 25, and that's – I would hate for it to slip past that point.
All right, Alan, hit yours up, and then I'll do the Twitter question, and maybe that'll be enough for Kyle.
Okay. Well, Kyle and I had talked about this a little off the air, so he's kind of prepared for it.
I'm prepared for nothing.
It was such a head scratcher when they decided to let DeJong play a little bit of shortstop starting last year in Arizona. Do you think the big club thought that this may be not flash in the pan is a poor choice of words, but the ebbs and flows in Diaz's career may have dictated that they could see him possibly having a down year and DeJong needed to be ready?
Yeah, for sure. For sure. As a matter of fact, when people were outraged about, you know, a lot of people wanted DeJong to stay at third because it didn't look like there was anybody to play third if Johnny Peralta fell apart, right? And mm-hmm. people were saying, oh, how can you move DeJong to short? How can you move him to short? Well, Alan, I think you're dead on. You snipped this out from the get-go. This was all about protecting themselves from Aledmys, you know. It makes sense. Paul DeJong, and he might not look like it because his head is kind of weird, but he is a very, very athletic kid. And
Kyle, talking about somebody's head looking weird. I mean, this is...
Look, I've got three craters in my head at least. I can't see the other two, so I'm leaving it at three. You look for things on other people, okay? That's your only defense mechanism. But yeah, he's a really smart and athletic kid, and he can handle shortstop. As a matter of fact, a lot of people were trashing him as a major league shortstop up until this point. And the only time he's been bad at short, and the relay throw thing tonight was weird, you know, I'll give him that. But the only time he's been bad at short since being at the major league level is when he hadn't played short in 3 weeks, except for like the however many games he was sent back to Memphis for, which was less than a week. He's new to the position, and he comes to the major leagues, and he plays second, which he hasn't played since college. And no one knows any better because he's that smart and that athletic. Yeah. And then you put him at the most difficult position, and he struggles at first because he hasn't played it. And he so now that he's playing it every day, you can see the difference in how he was when he first came to the major league level. He's good, and Alan, you're dead on. They knew, you looked at the minor league level, they knew Edmundo Sosa wasn't going to be ready. Juan Herrera is a name lost in the dark, luckily, because people thought that he might be the next, he might be a major league caliber player, which he was never going to be. They knew that whatever shortstop options they had were too far away to supplement this team. They knew they couldn't give it to Johnny Peralta and Jed Jerko because both of those guys were exposed in 2016 and weren't going to be able to play short. And they looked at DeJong, and he was good enough in Arizona and during the fall league. And if you ask me, he's done a damn fine job in that role right now. I'm impressed with him, and I believe that's the reason why, Alan.
Well, you wouldn't, and it's funny, just watching just the small sample size that we've seen since he's been in the big leagues, I would never think that he wasn't a natural shortstop.
Mm-hmm.
He's quicker to the ball than Diaz was. And I'm a Diaz guy.
Yeah, me too. I checked that Diaz box too. And, you know, the thing that's totally underrated about what Paul DeJong can do is that arm is... I can't remember seeing a Cardinal shortstop with an arm like that in a very long time. You know, that's it's better than Brendan Ryan's was, and Ryan had a really solid arm.
Yeah, he made that play up the middle today that didn't look spectacular at all, but then he threw a laser and didn't shift his body to do it. And I go, his arm may be pretty dang good. I swear, it's the first thing I thought about.
Yeah, there was a play last year that sticks with me in Springfield. It was one of those Manny Machado like plays down the third base line. Mm-hmm. Except for he didn't have to lay out for it, and he didn't like throw it from his butt like Machado can do.
Yeah.
But he ranged past the bag, planted on his I'm left-handed, I can't figure out how righties throw. Give me a second. He planted on his right foot and threw a laser that beat the two hitter. And I don't remember who it was or what team, but it was a pretty speedy guy by at least four steps. And it wasn't like a laser down the line. It wasn't hit so hard that there was reason for him to beat the runner out to first so bad. He just laser lined it right there, and that's what he's capable of. He is an athlete, and he's a smart kid, and I hope he's around for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
I guess if you're going to play third, you probably most likely have a pretty good arm, and he has looked very sharp. It's just interesting. I mean, the Cardinals were saying, and I guess maybe they're going to, but they were saying all the right things about Diaz last year. I mean, Jumbo Zaluk, is even before Diaz came up, it felt like he wanted him to be that shortstop of the future, and they really kind of thought that's what they had, at least if you went by the public proclamations. And again, what else are you going to say? I didn't really see them. I mean, I'm sure that, like you said, DeJong was a good insurance, and then I'm not sure that they expected to have to use him, let's put it that way. Maybe they did, but I think they at least had a good thoughts on Diaz this year, like we all did. But now that he's hitting 200 at Memphis, you know, it kind of is disturbing. I mean, you've watched him, I'm sure, in this last week or so, and obviously you've seen him at the big league level. I mean, are we going to see Diaz in the big leagues again?
I don't know what to think. He looks better in the field. I guess maybe that's the most important thing to take at this point. He looks better in the field, and you know, maybe that's because he's a AAA shortstop. You know, that it could be that simple. He doesn't look like he's having any problems. He looked better than he's looked in the last, you know, year and a half at the major league level. Maybe he's just not quick enough to play the major league game at short. He doesn't have the range, but he does at Memphis. So he hasn't struggled at short. He's been really impressive at short, as a matter of fact. The bat is exactly the same. Mm. Nothing has changed. His approach hasn't changed. You know, he got off to a great start down in Memphis, and it was for the exact reason that you would think. Because teams were starting him out, pitchers were starting him out with fastballs early in. And he was punishing that, because that's what he does.
Yeah.
But as the count progressed, and as you know, as his time down in Memphis has progressed, they're starting to just live on the outside corner, and he can't do anything with it. And when he does something with it, it's lightly hit to an infielder or popped up shallow to an outfielder, if not shallow to an infielder. It's the exact same thing, and that's concerning for me. I don't think this is the last we've seen of Aledmys. At the very least, he'll be up in spring, or in spring. He'll be up in September. Both words start with S. I'm good there. he'll be up in September. At the very least, but he hasn't changed his approach, and he's not going to make it back up to the majors. You know what, I'm going to stop myself, because apparently you don't need to change your approach to make it back up to the majors for the Cardinals, as Randall Grichuk has proven time and time again. But I would think, that he's down there until something crazy happens, or he gets traded. Because I would use him. I don't know what kind of value he has. I don't know how much of his value has been tanked. But if I'm upgrading, if I'm downgrading, if I'm trading, maybe I try to move Aledmys and just and cut my losses, depending on what the return is. I really don't know. I don't know what to think. I'm just not happy with the fact that he hasn't changed his approach.
Yeah, it's really, I mean, given what he was doing last year and how well he was doing it, For him to struggle this much is sad. And you're right, it may be if the Cardinals do make that kind of shortstop move, and there were some people talking about, because I heard this and I thought I had, you know, stepped back in time somewhere along the way, because people are again talking about Troy Tulowitzki.
I'm at the forefront of that.
Yeah, the both of us.
Yeah. And I just feel like this is, you know, like, you know, 5 years ago, all over
2008.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, you know,
the only reason, not that I look for that to be a huge upgrade, which I do think it would be, I think Toronto would be willing to get rid of the contract, and I don't think you'd have to give up much for him. And I think this lineup may need another veteran in the middle. That's kind of what I was thinking on that deal.
And I can get that. It's just, I mean, you look at his numbers. It, granted, there's some injury and there's some other things, but boy, the difference between, I mean, as soon as he left Colorado, hasn't hit, but he's hitting 250 instead of 300, and that's a big deal, I think, because that's what I'd like to see the Cardinals get. And I know we're spoiled because we saw Albert Pujols, but I'd like to see that overall hitter, the guy that's going to hit 330 home runs, instead of, you know, I mean, that's the downside of Giancarlo Stanton, is he may hit, you know, 40 homers, but he may almost hit like 260, and you know, there's differences and variances, but that's not a whole different line than you saw out of Jed Jerko last year, you know. And do you want to pay a whole lot of money for a guy that could hit them a long way, but last I checked, the footage doesn't actually give you extra runs, so but you know, again, I'm not saying that I wouldn't take Giancarlo Stanton. I'm just saying I don't know how that fits into my dream world. So,
you know, I don't think he's listening. But if there's a chance that Rob Manfred is listening, I wouldn't be surprised if in 2 years he's proposing that if you hit a ball over 500 feet, you get an extra run. No, you're right. Where Tulo is really interesting to me in particular, if you're looking at his deficiencies. You go from Colorado, which is the ultimate hitter's park,
right,
to the AL's version of the ultimate hitter's park, and he fell off. You know, it's Camden and it's Rogers Center, and and you know, maybe Squeezebox Park, Minute Maid, but like those are the two places. I thought he was going to be safe at the Rogers Center, and that makes me wonder if there is something else going on there. Because he has been terrible. He was, you know what really, really, and I hadn't thought about this until right now, as I've been lobbying for Tulo for the very reasons that Alan said, because you'd be able to probably get him at a very low cost and hope for a rebound. But he's been terrible in the playoffs too. You know, he's gone absent in the playoffs for Toronto, and I had not thought about that until right now. And I definitely get not trading for Tulo. I looked at, you know, I think Ellen and I came from the same spot, like, all right, this is a guy who can still play short. We've had problems at short defensively. You know, if he's not healthy, you can always go back to the DeJong train, ride that out for a little bit, you know, like, but you're right. What you're really paying for is hope, and that hope being that he recovers some of the magic he's shown in the past in the National League.
Yeah, and I mean, that's not a contract that's over soon either. I mean, he's... under contract
2020,
until 2020 with a buy with an option for 21, and it's, you know, $20 million the next 2 years, and then $14 million that last year. I mean, not saying the Cardinals can't absorb that, but on a guy that is already not the bat that he was.
Yeah.
I mean, honestly, he's 32 this year, and I would have sworn he was like 40. I mean, because he feels like he's been around forever, and he's dropped off like that. I would not have expected him to be that young. So, you know, you could argue that, you know, going into a new place, getting a jolt, coming back to the National League. But, you know, if you can't hit in the AL East with those ballparks and those pitchers, I mean, and you come into a league where you're going to have to see people like Kershaw and Bumgarner, and I mean, granted, you're not going to see those guys all the time, and the NL Central doesn't have a lot of those kind of guys, but still, the pitching is better in the National League. So if you're not hitting in the American League, moving over to the National League is not necessarily the way you would expect that to improve, but possibly. Let's go to the Twitter question, not the Twitter question, but I put out there asking if anybody had prospects in particular that they wanted Kyle to talk about. And Troy Poole sixth suggested Michael Riley, Jordan Hicks, and Dylan Carlson. Guys that I know you are quite familiar with, so why don't you, Kyle, give us some rundown on these guys.
Yeah, we'll start with Michael Riley, because Michael Riley's a lot of fun. So Michael Riley is a 27th round pick in the 2006 draft, and it's such a corny, terrible joke, but he's out of a college called Flagler College, which I refuse to look up, because I'm kind of scared of it, to be honest with you. I don't know if it's real or not. I think it's one of those fake colleges that you get like a degree in like plastic bagging, and I'm not 100% sure. But he's a 22-year-old pitcher who's in total control. He's holding hitters in the Midwest League to 157 average, which, I mean, just think about that. People are hitting 157 against him, pardon me, hitting 157 against him, and he just keeps being, like, dominant after dominant after dominant performance. He just keeps putting these things up. Earlier in the week, he threw a complete game shutout, one hitter, struck out 12, no walks, obviously no earned runs. It had a MILB game score of 104. It had a Baseball Reference game score of 97. They allegedly get to the total by the same number, so I have no idea what the difference is. The deal with O'Riley, as far as from a scouting perspective, is he's not big. He barely touches 6 foot. Some people say he's under six. I think he's right at six. And he doesn't throw fast. His fastball hits 88 to 90. But he has an unusual slot that he throws off out of. It's like part Seth Maness, you know, where Seth Maness kind of had that like high arm slot that kind of came from his ear more than a rounding up, or, you know, it's not three quarters. It's like a catcher's delivery. So it's like part Seth Maness, part Jason Mott. And he throws a slider and a changeup and a fastball, and they all come from the exact same spot. There's no variance there. And that's just too much for the A-level hitters. His ERA in the season is 1.56. He is averaging almost a strikeout an inning. He's only walked 10 guys in 80 innings. It's just he's having the most – it is hands down the most dominant Cardinal pitcher in the organization. He was my 29th overall pick – he's my 29th rated prospect over at the Redbird Daily. And the only reason I'm holding off putting him even further is because he's just too good for the level he's at. He needs to prove that he can do it at an advanced level before I start moving him down, because his stuff is still, like, he has a really good changeup and a really good slider. They're both average. That slider, I think he can push that slider to above average, and that's going to be a big key. But the only way to find out exactly if it's above average at this point is if he can use it effectively with advanced hitters. So he's a really interesting prospect, a really interesting name to keep an eye on, and hopefully soon he gets promoted. There's three pitchers in the organization that are deserving of a promotion, and they all line up perfectly with each other. Two of them pitch on the same day, and one of them pitches the day after. O'Riley pitches for Peoria. Ryan Helsley pitches for Palm Beach. Those guys pitch on the same day. And in Springfield, Dakota Hudson pitches the day after. And all three of those guys need to be promoted. They're all ready for a promotion to the next level. And hopefully it happens soon, because right now they're all three of those guys, even though Hudson's coming off of kind of a rough start, all three of those guys are ready for the next challenge. So that's Mike O'Riley. Jordan Hicks is...
I want you to know, Flagler College has a beautiful campus. I just want you to know.
I can't have this conversation with you.
It is amazing to look at the pictures on their site, for sure. It's down there in Florida, so, you know, obviously, it's real. I guarantee you, it's real. I don't know if it's a good college, but it's a very good looking.
As I ranted there for 10 minutes, you created the website. You're not fooling me. I know what you're
doing. You obviously way overrate my skills. That's all I'm going to say. All right, go to Jordan Hicks.
So Jordan Hicks is is the he just got a promotion to Palm Beach. He was pitching at Peoria. He pitched really well. He got off to a great start, and then the Peoria rotation fell apart. We mentioned Roddy Williams falling apart. He and Hicks were supposed to be 1-2 in that rotation, both poised for a mid-season promotion to Palm Beach. Williams fell apart. The rest of that pitching staff fell apart until the beginning of May when Michael Riley got added to the rotation and Austin Sexton, who's now on the DL. But Jordan Hicks kept the Peoria rotation together. He had some battles early on where he was walking some guys, but he was doing everything he could to get to six innings. He was still putting up a solid amount of quality starts, even though he was struggling and teams were working him. And then something clicked right in the middle part, right at the end of May, I want to say. And he went back to being the Jordan Hicks that we all thought he was going to be at the beginning of the year and that all of the prospect rating services and scouts were talking about. He started using the curveball, which is the best curveball in the system. It, you know, some people think it'll grade out as a 70, which is a plus-plus pitch. He started using that more, and he has really good control of it. He's mixing in a changeup. He's using a cutter, but very, very slightly. He's still trying to get used to that. His fastball, he can dial up to the high 90s. During the All-Star game, they said it was hitting 101, 102. Most of those minor league guns are cooked. They're a little hotter than the reality. So he was probably hitting more than likely 97, 98, but still that plays terrifically. And he earned the promotion to Palm Beach over his last five or six starts. And it's great to see because he's one of these high upside guys that the organization needs to keep pushing through. He's highly sought after. He's highly thought of by other organizations. One of the Baseball America articles at the beginning of the year quoted another executive talking about how impressive Hicks is and how he's the next blooming arm in the Cardinals system. And then in his one start in Palm Beach that he had, he went five innings, let up five hits, three earned runs, one walk, 7 K. So he's right where he needs to be. And I would imagine that unless things get extremely unusual, he'll finish the year at Palm Beach, spend the next 2 months at Palm Beach. And he's in great shape because he's 20 years old. He's already at Palm Beach. He's going to be a name. Like, you'll see him start creeping on the top 10 list as Luke Weaver and Carson Kelly and Alex Reyes start falling off of these lists. So he's definitely a name to keep an eye on. He's like Michael Riley's small. He's 6 foot tall. He might weigh 180 pounds. He's a small guy. He's stocky. He's got a good like upper body build. But Hicks is a 6'2 prototypical pitcher. You know, of course he could be a little taller, but 6'2 is where you want him. He's a little over 200 pounds, and he seems to have it all. He has the repertoire and the pedigree and everything.
It sounds very good, and that's. I mean, that sounds like one of those kind of guys that gets into a deal, too, at a possibility. I mean, the Cardinals are going to want to hold on to as many of those kind of people as they can. But, you know, if we're talking about dealing from surplus, pitching in outfield is one of them, and that maybe that's where we're looking. Carlson, what do we got on him?
Dylan Carlson's interesting. Alan, if you're still there, as I've ran it on for what feels like 3.5 hours. You know, I mentioned earlier that we were talking about, you know, we both listened to the John Vooch interview on Frank Cusumano. And do you remember what Vooch said about Dylan Carlson?
I don't. I'm sorry.
No problem.
I was blown away by the Perez stuff.
Yeah, that was really interesting, too. That's something probably worth getting into, too. But I wouldn't doubt if you're not the only person who probably glazed over the little section about Dylan Carlson. So Frank Cusumano asked John Vooch who he thought had a chance to have star power in the organization that he might not have mentioned, which is really funny too, because during the entire Frank Cusumano interview, I was texting in questions frantically. And he at one point he's like, before he asked a question about Dylan Carlson, he's like, and I know that people are asking about Ryan Helsley and Randy Rosarena and Luis Robert. And I'm like, oh, God, he's calling me out. But He said that the one guy that he hadn't mentioned that he thinks has a potential to be an absolute superstar at the major league level is Dylan Carlson. And the reason is Dylan Carlson is an 18-year-old kid playing at a full season level, and he's holding his own. He got off to a terrible start because, A, he shouldn't have been at a full season level. He wasn't ready for that. But, B, he's rebounded. He's only hitting .235, which doesn't seem impressive, but he's had a really great last two months. He's been really great. He can play a corner outfield, right or left field. He's probably best suited for left. But he's 6'3". He's 200 pounds. He has an amazing feel for the strike zone. You don't see him taking check swings. You don't see him swinging at pitches way out of the zone. He understands the strike zone. He's a gym rat with an understanding of the game that very few players have. He was a first-round pick last year. He's a really, really, really interesting kid. And he had three doubles tonight. He hardly had any extra base hits over the first, a month and a half of the season. And he's turned that in to a nice little two home runs, 10 doubles. He's had a really good season and a half. So if you're it's funny, Alan just mentioned Delvin Perez. You look at Dylan Carlson, you look at Delvin Perez. They were both drafted. Dylan Carlson was 17 when he entered the organization. And Dylan Carlson has a maturity about him that allows him to play at Peoria and allows the organization to believe that he's going to work out of slumps, and he's rewarded it. It's been impressive. And then you look at Delvin Perez, who just had a demotion to the Gulf Coast League from Johnson City, and the reason they're given is so that he can work with Jose Oquendo, who's at the extended spring training facility, and be with him every day. Well, take that however you want. To me, that's an alarming sign. If you're bringing, you're bringing this kid down to work with an instructor specifically so early in the season. But that's not uncommon for 18-year-olds to go through, and Carlson isn't going through that, and he's getting better with experience, and he is going to be a name like this time next year that catches fire the way that Randy or Rosarena has, there probably isn't another like good offensive like Oscar Mercado has, maybe even so, That's the kind of way that this kid's going to catch fire in a year. And, if there's one name to keep an eye on who started the 2017 system in the organization that might be out of your average fan's view, it's Dylan Carlson, because he has all of the things between the ears and, the eyes for stardom. So keep an eye on Dylan Carlson.
And it's it's kind of fascinating to hear such high praise. I mean, a guy that, I know that they were talking about a lot when they drafted him, but again, you still feel like Perez should be getting all the accolades, and you're right, he's not yet. And I know we talked earlier about him being the guy that the Cardinals don't want to trade or won't trade, but how much damage has he done to his stock this year? I mean, not only with the demotion, but obviously before he was demoted, he threw a tantrum on the field, got pulled out of the game. Again, 18 years old, these things happen, but they don't seem to happen to top prospects in the Cardinal organization very often.
Yeah, they don't seem to happen to top prospects in baseball very often, right? I mean, look at the kid who was just traded for Jose Quintana. You've never heard one thing about Eloy Jimenez throwing his helmet. Yeah, and those things, they get reported now. It's not like what year were you guys born? No, it's not like not like 2000.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, we just lost Kyle.
Oh God. What Mark Saxon was trying to say you don't hear about that from the top prospects because they know how to conduct themselves because they've been in the spotlight since they were 15 years old in a lot of situations. Delvin Perez has been someone that scouts have been familiar with since he was 15 years old. Same thing with Eloy Jimenez. So it is concerning, and it goes to show you the maturity level, the difference in the maturity level between Carlson and Perez. And, you know, I wouldn't think that they'd hold that against Perez. And they're definitely giving him every opportunity to make amends for maybe some of his immaturity and, you know, some of his deficiencies. But, again, it just goes to show you how impressive Dylan Carlson is, because he isn't caught up in any of that stuff. And, you know, he's a coach's son. He understands baseball. And to me, that's the most impressive thing, other than his – I mean, he's a physical specimen. He could still stand to bulk up a little bit. He might be a little too wiry for his 6'3", 6'4 frame. But other than that, he's shown everything that you would want him to show. So, yeah, I'm so impressed with this kid.
All right, Alan, anything more for Kyle before we kind of wrap this section up?
Yeah, just one last question. Are they as loaded pitching as we think they are?
Yes. Yeah.
It sounds like it. I could tell it by your enthusiasm that was true.
Yeah, So I was tweeting back and forth with John Nagel today, and I'm actually anxious. Like, I feel a little bit of anxiety inside of me because of the pitching. Now, they're deep in outfield, but I don't feel that same anxiety. And the reason is, these guys now are kind of not stagnant, that's not fair, but they're at the point where they need to find out, like, a lot of these guys are ready for the next challenge. You know, they've never been in this position where they could literally promote someone and have someone backfill at that level that deserves that promotion. You know, normally, like, you know, say in the past, they brought Michael Wacha up. They would have to push Arturo Reyes to Memphis. He probably wasn't ready for Memphis, but they put him in anyways in trial by fire because he's their most ready of the group. Well, that's not the case anymore. Now it's, wait, we've got two guys at some levels that are ready for a promotion. Peoria is a perfect example. Jordan Hicks got a promotion to Palm Beach, and Michael Riley's been the more effective of the two pitchers. And he had to stay at Peoria because sometimes that's just how the pecking order works. You know, Jordan Hicks has more electric stuff, so he needs to go first, and he should have gone first in all reality. But, you know, Palm Beach kind of has the same thing. Junior Fernandez has not been pitching lights out exactly. He's had an up and down season. But realistically, this is the time of year that he should be moving to Springfield. But he's probably second in line at this point. I would hope he's second in line behind Ryan Helsley, who should almost certainly be at Springfield. And both of those guys were passed up by Zach Gallen, who was drafted in the third round last year. And, you know, he tasted Memphis and held his own a year after being drafted. And we didn't mention Austin Gomber, who's had a rough start this week, but it has turned his season around since coming back from an injury. And Sandy Alcantara, who's pitched better as of late. You know, they're in a good shape. And all of this, you know, again, my excitement level, but John Gant pitched great again tonight. So they still have – Marco Gonzalez pitched great yesterday. Mm. It's nonstop.
That's awesome.
And it's awesome. It's so exciting. And you know, if you get a chance to watch these kids through MILB TV, or if you can find some video to watch them on YouTube, it's not just the stat line either. It's the scouting standpoint too. So that's what has me most excited. It's not just looking at the stat line and saying – Mike O'Reilly's held hitters to a 170 average, and he has a 1.5 ERA. It's, you see his release point. You see the break on his pitches. You see how he's toying with hitters. You see violent swings that don't come close to the ball. And it is way more than just stat line depth. It is real, substantial feeder to the major league depth. In some capacity or the other. Like, to me, Mike O'Reilly is a perfect Matt Bowman prototype. Mm. You know, like, that's the Seth. I'm so stuck on Seth Maness with Mike O'Reilly. There's a little Seth Maness and another kid named Nick Petrie, who I'm not even going to get into, but he's like somewhere in between those two. So that's deep. That's depth. If you can have a guy like Mike O'Reilly at you know, middle A level ball, who
can have a chance to, you know, help the major league club, then it's the most pitching depth I've seen. I've rambled on for so long just to say yes. It is the most major league potentialed pitching depth I've seen out of the Cardinals organization since I've been following in the last 10 years.
That's exciting.
Well, and it really feels like, I mean, listening to that and listening to the backlog that they have and stuff, that, you know, doing a move like trading Lance Lynn, whether you consider it a sell or whatever, almost needs to happen just to start the talent flowing upward a little bit. And obviously it may be they need to trade, you know, one or two others, but, you know, get those people to be able to move up and try the new levels that they need to be at.
I agree. I completely agree. I just, you know, I've been so impressed with what Luke Weaver, I mean, just because you bring up Lance Lynn, I've been so impressed with what Luke Weaver's done. I was so impressed with how he pitched out of the pen. I know some people are down on him, but I would like to see him in the major league rotation, you know, and that the only way that happens is if they move Waka, if, you know, to the pen, which isn't going to happen for a while because Waka's somewhat course corrected. That's bought him enough leeway for at least a couple starts of tanking or having trouble. The only way for it to happen, the only clear way for it to happen, is to trade Lance Lynn. And then, like you just said, Daniel, that allows the backfilling to happen. That allows Hudson to go to AAA. It allows Helsley to go to AA. It allows O'Reilly to go to Peoria. And it allows probably Sam Tuiz, who's in State College, to move up. Or Brett Seeberger, who was a 10th round pick in this year's draft, to move up to Peoria. And that's what they need. That's the position they're in right now.
All right. Well, it's been enjoyable to talk about the minor league. Tom, perhaps you need to start thinking about your own podcast to do this on a regular basis. Because,
in the immortal words of Doug Vaughn, I'm pressed for time.
you know, if you could find it, I think it would be enlightening for Cardinal Nation to hear about these prospects on a regular basis, and especially some of the ones that we don't hear about all the time. We'll wrap it for tonight, but before we do, Alan and I want to especially send out a shout-out, thanks, commendations to the man, the myth, the legend, Cardinal Gifts on Twitter for our new Meet Me at Mutual logo, which is well overdue. We were needing one for quite some time. And so we did, he was gracious enough to fill that void for us, and it's updated, and you should be seeing it now around any place that you see this, except for iTunes, that still has Dan Buffett's picture up for some reason or another. Nothing against Dan, but I would like to get that replaced, but it just never seems to happen for some reason. So, until next, like I said, I know we've run long, but I think the look at the minors was definitely worth it.
Absolutely.
Alan and I will be back next week, and, you know, by next week we're getting to the Cubs series, and maybe we'll have a little bit more clarity about what this team is going to do, or maybe they'll have done something. I know it would be a little early for them to do something this week, but it'd be really nice if they did, and maybe put us out of our misery a little bit. So, for
Kyle's segment could be huge next week, because we may be learning some new faces.
That's right. Yeah, we may have to have Kyle back on to explain all these new prospects that we just got. So, but for Kyle, for Alan, I'm Daniel. Good night.
Good night.
Suter from the belt to the plate. A swing and a miss, and that's a winner. That's a winner. A World Series winner for the Cardinals.